From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The death of eight bells at Churchill Downs last Saturday has once again focused attention on the safety of thoroughbred racehorses. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Racing Chroniclers William Knack and Max Wattman. Also, the New Orleans Hornets are buzzing after their full-time return to their home hive, and Philly fans anticipate their first championship in 25 years. Also ahead, the allure of sumo wrestling for Japanese fans and for visitors.
I would one day, just for the experience, just for the Japanese experience, something you have to do, and I was there about 2 minutes and my mouth just fell open and that was it, it was over.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. When Game 3 of the NBA's semifinals began last night, it looked as if the Los Angeles Lakers might stretch their lead in the series over the Utah Jazz to 3-0. The Lakers led in the early going, 11-3. Shortly thereafter, however, Utah's Carlos Boozer snatched the spotlight from LA's Kobe Bryant, and Utah ended up winning Game 3, 104-99. In the other Western Conference semifinal, the New Orleans Hornets have a 2-1 lead over the defending champion San Antonio Spurs. Joining me now to discuss the possibility that the Hornets will buzz the Spurs for two more wins is Chris Colston, who's covering that series for USA Today. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be on.
The Hornets and Spurs are the West's number 2 and 3 seeds, respectively, and their regular season records were identical. To what can we attribute New Orleans' current advantage in the series?
I think the overriding factor in this that I've seen so far, Bill, is just the younger and springier legs. They're just more athletic than San Antonio. You know, in the first two games, they beat them to most of the loose balls. They pulled away late in the game when people were tired. They hit the offensive glass and basically just out-hustled San Antonio. And instead of making the Spurs look experienced and savvy, they made them look a little bit old and slow.
Well, younger and springier is good because not so long ago the Hornets roster was considered ragtag. How did this team manage to turn it around so quickly after racking up 3 consecutive losing seasons?
A lot of the credit has to go to GM Jeff Bauer. You know, he took over 3 years ago, and he had been with the team for a long time and kind of knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to bring players in who would accept roles. They got lucky in the draft when Chris Paul fell to them with the 4th pick. But then they teamed him with the player David West. They sort of clicked that first year, and they needed an outside shooter who could keep defenses honest and allow Paul to penetrate. So Peja Stojakovic, you know, a free agent signing. And then they made the trade for Tyson Chandler, a center, a young guy who could run and really hadn't kind of hit his potential yet. And then Morris Peterson, the other starter, has lent a little bit of experience to a young team. And so there you've got a starting team that really meshes well and plays well together and has great chemistry.
You mentioned Chris Paul, and you are one of the people who's been fortunate enough to have witnessed a Chris Paul fake pass. And so I need to ask you, did it happen so quickly that you couldn't even really see it or appreciate it?
He's extremely quick, Bill. That's the overriding impression that you get when watching him is his court intelligence and his quickness. Because he is a good shooter, but not a great one yet. I think he's going to continue to develop his outside shot, and if he does, he really could go down as one of the all-time greats in NBA history. Thursday night, he had a head fake on a drive where he was going around a defender and pretended to make a pass with a head fake, continued to drive on, and then threw an alley-oop, I believe, to Chandler for a slam dunk. Every game you watch him play, he does something amazing.
Over the previous two seasons, the Hornets played a large portion of their so-called home games in Oklahoma City. I wonder if at least some of this season's success can be attributed to the fact that the Hornets played all 41 of their home games at home in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. And it took a little bit of time for the New Orleans fans to catch on to this team, but and the crowds weren't all that great early in the year, but, you know, as you well know, they got better and better, and the sellouts started coming one after another. And it really made a difference. The players talked about it constantly after both Game 1 and Game 2 wins, what an impact the crowd had on them. And it's been very important in the semifinal round of the NBA playoffs. I mean, through Thursday night's games, the home teams were a perfect 10-0 in the NBA, and it just goes to show when teams are at this level and they're really good, any little edge makes a difference, and the fans have made a difference. So this series is obviously coming back to New Orleans, and the fans can make a real difference in their team's success.
Well, that's an interesting point, because even before Katrina and before the Hornets had to leave New Orleans for a time, there was a lot of doubt about the feasibility of maintaining an NBA team in New Orleans, the smallest NBA market. It sounds as if, as long as the team is very good, that's not an issue.
Yeah, you know, it's great to be able to give people something to cheer for and rally around. And the Saints are there, but they're one of a handful of NFL teams that has never made it to a Super Bowl, and it's particularly galling when New Orleans has hosted so many Super Bowls. But with the Hornets, you've got a team that is built. It's young. It's got a superstar who's also a great individual. He's a guy that you can build around. He just turned 23 this week. I mean, he's a guy you can build around for the next 10 to 12 years if you can re-sign him when his contract expires. So, I mean, they are set up, Bill, as well as any team in the NBA right now. I mean, you can't look at another team that has more good young players with a brighter future than the Hornets. I mean, they're really just at this point just tweaking their roster if they can keep the team together. I really see them being a dominant team for a long time, and it's something I think the city really needs, and it could do a lot for that city.
Should the Hornets and the Lakers advance and face each other in the Western Conference Finals, league MVP Kobe Bryant would face Hornets point guard Chris Paul, who came in second, of course, for that award. That would be a dynamic matchup, wouldn't it?
Well, that's what I think it's headed toward, with all due respect to the defending champion Spurs. And they looked great in their Game 3 win, and I do expect this to be a very tough series, and San Antonio is not going to back off. But I do see New Orleans ultimately winning this with this series, and it is going to be just a tremendous Western Conference Finals if that's the case, because it's clear that the Lakers are en route to the finals. And to have two of the very best players in the league going head-to-head is something I think the NBA would really relish. And I think a lot of people across the country would love to see New Orleans get to that point and be pulling for them, you know, if they do face the Lakers. But that obviously is getting ahead of ourselves. They've got a lot of basketball ahead of them, but you're right, it would be a compelling series.
Chris Colston is covering the New Orleans-San Antonio series for USA Today. He joined me on the line from San Antonio. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
It might be accurate to say the Pittsburgh Penguins had waddled to a one-game-to-none lead in their NHL Eastern Conference Finals series with the Philadelphia Flyers last night, except that it was the Penguins who flew 4-2. Still, in the span of just a year, the Flyers went from being the worst team in the NHL to one of the best, and Philadelphia fans hope that these Flyers will put an end to the city's 25-year championship drought. Joel Rose reports.
I'm standing outside Philadelphia City Hall, and on a tower about 500 feet over my head is a statue of William Penn, founder of Pennsylvania. Now, for decades, this was the tallest structure in town, until the 1980s when they built some skyscrapers downtown. Since then, not a single Philadelphia sports team has won a title in one of the four major team sports. A lot of people will tell you that is just a coincidence, but some say it's a curse, the curse of Billy Penn. Do you believe in the curse of Billy Penn?
Yes. Yes, I do.
No, I don't believe in any curses.
Just a coincidence.
Pure coincidence, unadulterated, yeah.
Do you believe in the curse of Billy Penn?
It does make you think. I mean, it is kind of strange. I mean, because it's been, what, four teams and 23? I mean, it's been over 100 different chances. I mean, that's a lot to win one championship. So it does make you think a little bit.
Before all the skyscrapers that now tower above City Hall, the last Philadelphia team to win it all was the 76ers, led by Moses Malone and Julius Erving in long socks and short shorts. They brought home the NBA championship in 1983. Since then, the 76ers, Phillies, and Eagles have all made it to the big game and lost. That's the longest drought of any city with four major professional teams. Craig Neuschafer says long-suffering Philadelphia fans are desperate for a title.
We've gotten very close in a number of sports for a number of years, but close but no cigar kind of wears thin after a while, so we want that parade.
Once a generation, right? We're due for one.
Your words, not mine, but that resonates with me, yeah. My father-in-law can remember a championship, I can't.
And so the hopes of Philly fans are pinned on the Flyers. The team that finished last season with the worst record in the league is just a few wins away from the Stanley Cup Finals. Orange and black Flyers jerseys are easy to spot on the street. Mike Gaynor wore his to work. Says the team is a good fit for this blue-collar town.
They got a lot of resilience. They just keep working, keep grinding, and do what they got to do.
Right now, everybody's with the Flyers. Everybody's all flyered up. Right now, they played better than you expect them to, so anything more than this is gravy.
Joe Pinto knows the Flyers are underdogs against their cross-state rivals, the Pittsburgh Penguins, but he isn't worried. They weren't supposed to win in the first two rounds of the playoffs either.
Well, the Flyers are playing, anything could happen, because they're a different team than they were before. They have a lot of heart, a lot of youth. Everything's just fitting right, making a lot of people happy, especially my wife. She's a Flyer nut. Matter of fact, she got so excited when they won at Game 7, she jumped up and got dizzy and fainted. Had to pick her up. So I kind of watch her now at the end of games.
Flyers fans have been waiting a long time for this, even by Philadelphia standards. The team hasn't won the Stanley Cup since 1975. Terry Taylor remembers the party after that title.
Insane is what it was. Yeah. I'd never seen anything like that. Everyone just came out of their houses, got into their cars and driving around, and they were beeping their horns, and everybody headed down Broad Street. It was crazy.
Taylor admits all those seasons of losing have taken a certain toll on fans, such as herself.
At first, it's, of course, a disappointment, but then when the next season comes around, you're still that hopeful fan that this year will be the year, that's all.
Taylor says she does not believe in the curse of Billy Penn, but her friend Anna Damsky does. Damsky says the city has only made it worse by dressing the statue of William Penn in extra, extra, extra large team jerseys and hats.
Every time they put something up and get everybody gung-ho, we fail.
Meaning a jersey. They put a jersey on him.
Jersey, a hat, you name it, we fail. So
you're saying please don't put anything on William Penn this year.
Yep.
When you're a Philadelphia sports fan, you can't be too careful. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose.
Thanks to the curse, I don't know what's worse, a team that never has hope, or a team that believes only to leave the Philly fans trying to cope. Since they have suffered, it's gotten much tougher to ever expect them to win. It makes a fan wonder how long they'll be under the curse of Billy Penn.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Measuring a fan's passion for his team or his favorite player is a subjective business, but who can argue that David Witthoft of Ridgefield, Connecticut, has not been ex-Green Bay Packers quarterback Brett Favre's most earnest supporter? Mr. Witthoft received a Brett Favre jersey for Christmas in 2003. He wore the jersey, which his mother washed a few times a week, for the next 1,581 days, neglecting for the first time to don it on April 23rd of this year, his 12th birthday. Even Favre's retirement failed to alter young Witthoff's styling, but according to his dad, vanity ultimately won out. Chuck Witthoff said Monday that his son began to become concerned about his appearance, quote, when the jersey barely came down to his belt line.
Rejoice, the pack is back.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the intertwined tales of Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus. But first, the collapse and euthanizing of Eight Bells following last week's Kentucky Derby has occasioned discussion of what's wrong with thoroughbred horse racing. Has the industry's method of breeding made the animals more and more fragile? Are they required to run too far before they're fully grown? Are the track surfaces unnecessarily cruel? Are the jockeys handling the horses appropriately? Should some of the drugs trainers use on their horses be banned? Joining me now is Max Wattman, turf correspondent for the New York Sun. Max, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And also on the line is former Sports Illustrated writer William Knack. He's also the author of Secretariat and My Turf. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be here, Bill.
Let's start with you, Bill. Everybody watching the Derby last weekend was shocked when Eight Bells broke down. Should they have been surprised?
I wasn't, and I know other people in the breeding business who were not. She is inbred three times to a very unsound horse named Raisin Native, a very fast racehorse who was very unsound himself. He was the son of an unsound horse named Native Dancer, one of the greatest racers of all time. But to have her three times in a pedigree is an invitation to disaster. And I know one breeding consultant down in Kentucky who, as the horses were going into the starting gate, said, I just hope this filly doesn't break down.
Mm.
And, you know, you can, horses have been running on racetracks for many, many years. They've been running as 2- and 3-year-olds for many, many years. That has nothing to do with it. The jockey is not going to beat on a horse knowing that he's going to go down and perhaps kill himself. And the trainer is not known as a guy who breaks down horses. The seeds of her destruction lay in her pedigree.
Max, did you have a similar feeling when you witnessed this terrible accident?
Well, I certainly wouldn't have anticipated it. And, you know, certainly we should try to pay attention to breeding. I mean, I think if you start taking native dancer horses off the track, there's not going to be many left. I mean, that's that horse is in a lot of thoroughbreds and a lot of thoroughbreds that don't break down.
Churchill Downs features a dirt surface. A lot of the other tracks have gone to synthetic surfaces in part because they are supposed to be kinder to the feet and legs of the horses. Max, have we enough evidence to conclude that that is the case?
It doesn't seem so. We're gathering that evidence. There's a lot of rumors going around. Some people seem to like it a lot, the new surfaces. Other people don't. Some people seem to think it's better for training than it is for racing. But I think that there are people trying very hard to gather that information, and I think we'll have it. I would hope we'll have it within a year or two. I think it's too early to make broad generalizations about whether or not it's effective. But it seems to be a good idea to me because it means that people are paying attention. And the more attention paid, the better off the horses are.
This week, the Jockey Club announced that they have established a safety committee. But, Bill, based on what you're saying, I don't know quite where they should start.
Boy, I don't either. They're facing a major problem here. And because of this tremendous amount of unsound blood in the breed, I just don't know if the problem's solvable. They're trying to do it by way of the racetrack. They're trying to keep horses going to the races through medication. Who's breeding nowadays for durability? I don't know anybody that sits there like years ago, the Whitneys and the Vanderbilt. All these people used to breed horses back in the 20s and 30s. And one of the things they aimed for was breeding for durability and stoutness. But since all of those families are gone and they're not trying to, quote, improve the breed anymore, all they're doing is trying to sell horses for sale. I mean, there are horses that are producing as many foals in 2 or 3 years as an old stallion used to produce in a lifetime. Because they're breeding not only in North America, but then they go to another hemisphere and have an entirely another breeding season. Plus, they're getting more mares pregnant because they're better at it than they used to.
But how is that inherently bad for the sport?
Why is that?
Yeah.
Because it narrows the gene pool into the kind of narrowness that we have with Raise a Native, with Northern Dancer, and all of the old, find me the old sire lines that were sound, Blenheim, Mahmood, even Domino, all those American sire lines that had soundness in them, Bulldog, they're disappearing.
Max, have you any suggestion for approaching this problem?
Well, I mean, one of my central suggestions would be to not perceive it as quite as widespread of an epidemic as Bill would have it. I mean, I think that, you know, while certainly there are problems, it's not as if the thoroughbred is unsound. I mean, that would be too broad of a statement, I think. And I think that, you know, as we move forward, it's just a matter of paying attention to what's best for the horse. And as long as people have that in mind, and I think, you know, people certainly have that in mind now, the horses will be better off. Worrying about the surfaces is a great step in the right direction. Continuing to regulate medications is also a step in the right direction. You know, we've got the hand we've been dealt, and these are all good solutions for where we are now.
Well, the problem, I think, is that Eight Bells was not an isolated case. This is hardly a first breakdown. Why weren't people paying attention to the kinds of things you're talking about for many years?
Well, I think they have been. But it's the unfortunate truth that it takes something spectacular to really generate a movement, you know, to really get action on something. You know, sure, horses break down. She was not the first horse to break down, but they don't do it on TV.
Racing is regulated at the state level currently. There's no national commissioner of horse racing. Would establishing a national governing body be likely to produce safer conditions, Max?
I've never seen that throwing bureaucracies at things solves problems. It'd certainly be nice for everyone to work from the same standards, but, you know, creating another layer, you know, putting some more people in offices, I don't think that's necessarily the answer.
We still live in a free society. And the marketplace rules here. And I can't imagine somebody telling an old hard boot breeder in Kentucky that he can't breed this mare to this stallion because you're going to get three doses of Raisinative in the pedigree. You know, I just cannot possibly, I cannot see that happening. But I'm as skeptical as Max is on it.
One final question for both of you, and Max, why don't you take it first? As you watch the Preakness next weekend, will you be rooting for Big Brown to establish himself as a Triple Crown contender, or will you just be hoping for a race that's free of injuries?
I'll be rooting for Big Brown. I mean, the truth of the matter is that racing goes on. You know, we've got two stories now. One of them is a triumph, and one of them is a tragedy, and it'd be a shame to take the race away from Big Brown because of eight belts.
Bill?
Yeah, I'll be rooting for Big Brown to win, but I'll also be holding my breath after going through Barbaro and now Eight Bells, and then before that, Go for One and Ruffian, just holding my breath and just hoping that nobody gets hurt. And I think about it all the time now. I never used to think about it when I was a young person. Now as an older person, I just hope nobody gets hurt here.
William Knack is the author of Secretariat and My Turf. He spoke with me from his home in Washington, D.C. Bill, thanks very much for joining me.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
And Max Wattman is the turf correspondent for the New York Sun. Max, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Over 18 years, Arnold Palmer won 62 times on the PGA Tour. During his 22 years on the tour, 11 of which overlapped Palmer's career, Jack Nicklaus won 73 times. According to Ian O'Connor, whose new book is Arnie and Jack, Palmer, Nicklaus, and Golf's Greatest Rivalry, the numbers, impressive as they are, barely begin to tell the story. Ian O'Connor joins me now from Piscataway, New Jersey. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
From 1960, when Arnold Palmer won both the Masters Tournament and the U.S. Open, until 1973, when he left the tour, the number of people playing golf in the U.S. more than tripled. For lots of people who watch tournaments on television, Arnold Palmer was golf. Does that explain why Jack Nicklaus was initially regarded as the guy in the black hat?
Absolutely, Bill. I think Arnold Palmer, he certainly doesn't have the major championships that Jack earned or that Tiger Woods has earned. But he definitely is the most important figure in the history of the sport for the very reason that he was its first television star. When Arnold first started in the mid-50s on the tour, 25% or so of American households had TV. In 1960, when he dramatically wins the Masters and the U.S. Open back-to-back in great comeback fashion, about 80 to 85% of American households have TV. And Arnold was the perfect TV star. He was good-looking. He was charismatic. He had that Errol Flynn-like flair. The masses gravitated toward him because he was the son of a greenskeeper. And golf was a blue-blood sport, and he brought it to the blue-collar guy. And I think that's why he is the most important player the sport's ever seen.
In golf, players call penalties on themselves, and spectators are admonished to be quiet and courteous. But talk a little about some of the things Palmer's fans did to distract and discourage Jack Nicklaus.
Well, I think, Bill, the most prominent example of the verbal abuse that Arnie's Army, as it was called, hurled Jack's way was at the 1962 U.S. Open at Oakmont in Pennsylvania, which was about 40 miles from where Arnold grew up in Latrobe. And the crowd or the gallery was really sort of filled with beard-up steel workers, iron workers, real blue-collar Arnie kind of folk, and it just was an unusual golf crowd. Well, Jack was a rookie, had never won on the PGA Tour. Arnold was the king of the world. He was the three-time Masters champ. And the verbal abuse was along the lines of fat Jack, fat guts. I mean, they referred to his weight constantly. And it got so severe that at one point, Jack Nicklaus's father, Charlie, just couldn't take it anymore. And Charlie did not have a bad temper. But he turned and went to attack a pro-Palmer heckler. And Woody Hayes, of all peacemakers, happened to grab Charlie Nicklaus and held him back. And if you're familiar with Woody Hayes' history as a football coach at Ohio State, you know that if he's your peacemaker, you've got serious problems.
Yeah, Woody Hayes was known to grab opposing players and toss them to the ground rather than allow them to proceed toward the goal.
And actually, he punched a football player at Clemson University in the Gator Bowl and lost his job the next day for doing that. You know, the interesting thing, Bill, is that during that tournament in 1962, the U.S. Open at Oakmont, as bad as it was for Jack Nicklaus, and he said he blocked it all out, and he won the tournament, so he did a fairly good job of doing that. Barbara Nicklaus and Winnie Palmer, the two wives in the mix, they walked together through the entire tournament and became friends for life, which to me, and I write this in Arnie and Jack, that the wives' friendship really kept the husband's relationship from ever getting to DEF CON 1. I think if it wasn't for Barbara and Winnie, these guys would have had fisticuffs once or twice on the tour.
Well, as you say, besides being rivals on the course, there was considerable personal friction between Palmer and Nicklaus. How did that begin?
Well, I think it began, well, it began on the golf course, but it really intensified with their business pursuits. They competed probably more ferociously in business than they ever did on the golf course, competing for commercial endorsements, competing for golf course design contracts, and they each hosted his own PGA Tour tournament. Arnold had Bay Hill, which is now the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Jack Nicklaus had the Memorial at Muirfield Village at his club in Ohio. That's where it really got more personal. In fact, Arnold and Jack refused to play in each other's tournament for 8 consecutive years, from 1985 through 92.
You'll pardon me for laughing, but this really sounds like warring children, doesn't it?
Well, they were very much like fifth graders most of the time. In fact, when I contacted each person and let them know I was doing this book, they both said no at first, although they ended up cooperating, and their families couldn't have been more accessible and candid and agreeable. Jack even gave me a 5-hour interview on his private jet. But Arnold Palmer, when he said no, he said, well, let me tell you something. If Jack decides to help you, give me a call back and maybe I'll change my mind. And that's the way these guys were.
In 2001, Masters Tournament organizers arranged for Palmer, Nicklaus, and Gary Player to play together. This was fine with Palmer, not so fine at all with Nicklaus. Why was that?
Well, Bill, 3 years earlier, he almost won the Masters at age 58, Jack did, on one good hip. He was going into hip replacement surgery, and he outplayed the defending champion, Tiger Woods, who was 36 years younger than Jack. So here he is, his second straight year, because they did it in 2000 as well, and he's like, you know, listen, guys, I'm better than Arnold Palmer and Gary Player. I should be out there playing with Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson. What are you guys doing? But anyway, I'm out there on the 14th green on Friday in 2001, and this was really the first seed for the book. And Arnold walks towards me. I'm standing with the fans, and he starts clowning around with them. And Jack's trying to make the cut. He's standing over a putt, and he looks over, and he can't believe that Arnold is making this commotion while he's trying to make the cut at the Masters. And he shoots him this dagger. You know, Arnold sort of tips his cap, and the crowd laughs again, and Jack doesn't laugh. He just sort of shakes his head in disgust and goes back to his putt. But that little picture scene told me some big picture things about their relationship and how different they were as human beings and as golfers. And that's really where I thought about doing this book.
I'm speaking with Ian O'Connor, the author of Arnie and Jack, and you're listening to Only a Game. Toward the end of Arnie and Jack, you make the point that neither Palmer nor Nicklaus did anything to promote the integration of the tour or the integration of the exclusive clubs where the tournaments were played, whereas Gary Player was very active in that regard. The same was true of the dispute over whether the Augusta Club should admit women. Were Palmer and Nicklaus just always playing it safe?
I think for the most part, yes, and certainly Arnold was. Arnold never wanted to get within a par five of any controversy of any sort. Jack, though, you know, in Arnie and Jack, in the book, he did concede two things. One, he believes women should be allowed in as members at Augusta National. It's the first time he has said anything like that. Arnold Palmer has never addressed the issue. In the early 70s, when Jack built his country club, Muirfield Village, in Ohio, he made sure the first 10 members were of different ethnic and racial backgrounds, including an African-American man. And that was long before it was fashionable to do that. So I give Jack credit on those fronts. But Jack conceded that, you know, back then, we were just golfers. We were just looking to win tournaments. We weren't crusaders. And even though the civil rights movement was really sort of exploding all around us, we weren't focused on that. And in retrospect, we should have said more.
Ian, you talked a little bit about Arnold Palmer's influence on the game. What about Jack Nicklaus's contribution and his ultimate influence?
Well, I think Jack's influence was really measured simply by the greatness of his skill. And Jack was the first player to come along to prove that Ben Hogan would not go down as the greatest player of all time. And I think since rivalries are the lifeblood of all sports, whether it's Russell Chamberlain, Red Sox, Yankees, Michigan, Ohio State, Everett Navratilova, I think Jack Nicklaus and his greatness and the fact that he presented the perfect opposite to share that rivalry with Arnold, I think that took golf to a new level. In fact, I think as great as it is for the sport to have the world's most recognizable athlete in Tiger Woods playing it, I think golf would be better served if Tiger had an Arnie to go with his Jack. And I think most golf fans really share that feeling that, boy, the good old days were really Arnie and Jack and what those two men had.
Ian O'Connor is the author of Arnie and Jack, Palmer, Nicklaus, and Golf's Greatest Rivalry, published by Houghton Mifflin. He joined me from Piscataway, New Jersey. Ian, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
He rode into town with a club in his hand. He was ready to take on any man. He had fire in his eyes and two strong wrists. He could hit him hard, and I'll tell you this, he was bad. Big Bad Arnold.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon. Bill Littlefield has tended NPR's candy store for a long time. But Only a Game isn't the only Saturday source for sweets. You can hear our sports commentator, Ron, Rock Candy Rappaport. Nobody actually calls him that. And Nougat, Nuggets of the News from around the world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR Choose. News, that is, news.
You say in Miami the Dolphins play football? Big deal. In Los Angeles, Dr. Dean Pomerleau has trained Comet the Goldfish to play not only football, but basketball as well. Comet can also push a tiny rugby ball over a set of posts, play fetch with a hoop, and slalom around a series of poles, all of which has led Dr. Pomerleau to conclude that, quote, fish are more intelligent than people give them credit for. Dr. Pomerleau, who reinforces the behavior of his trained performers with rewards of food, maintains that fish can learn all sorts of what he calls competitive tricks and suggests that people in the market for a dog might want to consider a fish instead, unless they also wish to dissuade potential burglars.
It's like a fish in a goldfish bowl. It's like two fish in a goldfish bowl.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, grab your mawashi and come on down to the Bosch Show. We're going to rumble sumo style. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Fierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
That's a dangerous suggestion you just made. Let's continue.
Who knows what, what it will all lead to.
Wabasho, gosho.
In any case, former New England Patriots video assistant Matt Walsh turned over eight, count them, eight videotapes to the NFL this week, and one reportedly shows that the Patriots had stolen offensive signals. Walsh will meet with Commissioner Roger Goodell on Tuesday. What do you think the outcome of that meeting will be?
I think the outcome will be that perhaps the New England Patriots will get a gentle nudge from the league again and a promise not to do it ever again. Of course, the great hole in the story is that there apparently is no videotape of the St. Louis Rams walkthrough before the Super Bowl in February of 2002. That was supposedly the smoking gun. That was the one thing everybody thought Matt Walsh had. He didn't have it. That's what's going to take the air out of the story, I believe.
Walsh is also scheduled to meet on Tuesday with Arlen Specter, the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the sigh that you just gave us indicates that this could, in theory, go on forever.
Well,
right?
I mean, I can't see, you know, Arlen Specter mustering a lot of enthusiasm among his colleagues for this at this point. So, no, I think whatever happens in the Senate is going to take place largely behind closed doors.
A quick glance at the NBA playoff results might lead one to think that the Celtics are cruising through their second-round series against the Cavaliers. They're up 2-0, but it hasn't been that easy, has it?
Well, the first game was a two-headed cow. I mean, it was a freak. It was what happens when two defensive-oriented teams get together and don't shoot at all. The second game, which was 89-73, was a little bit better. The Celtics have done a great job in their first two games solving LeBron James, who was 6-for-24 in Game 2 after a horrendous Game 1. We'll have to see if they can do it on the road. They couldn't do the same stuff on the road against Atlanta that they could at home, so we'll see if they've gotten any better at that.
A national pizza chain offered 23-cent pizzas this week to outraged Cavalier fans in Ohio after one of its Washington, D.C. franchises distributed T-shirts characterizing LeBron James, number 23, as a crybaby for complaining about hard fouls. Has that smoothed over whatever hard feelings might have lingered?
Well, I suspect it's smoothed over some of them, but I think Cleveland Cavaliers fans can only hope that sooner or later, you know, Cadillac or Rolex insults LeBron James.
I like that idea because I can't see standing in a long line for a
pizza,
23-cent
pizza.
The NHL Conference Finals are underway. Detroit dispatched Dallas with ease on Thursday. Are predictions that the Cup will be going home to the Motor City premature?
I don't think so. I think they're pretty plainly the best team in the league right now. The Eastern Conference doesn't have anybody that can stay with them, I don't think. And Dallas eliminated the defending champion, so I think it's everybody chasing Detroit.
It's a very good thing that the Detroit Pistons beat the Orlando Magic by more than 3 points in Game 2 of their series, Charlie, because a post-game analysis of that game indicated that three of the points scored by Detroit shouldn't have counted. What happened
this
there?
This is real old-school NBA, where you would hire the pliant junior high biology teacher to run the clock in the War Memorial Auditorium, thereby getting you all the time you might need. Chauncey Billups hit a field goal on a play that took 5.7 seconds to develop. The problem is the clock had frozen at 4.8 seconds left to play. So, yes, it took almost a full second longer than it should have. The point should not have counted. And the NBA is sort of saying, well, you know, that's the way things are.
Elsewhere in the NBA, though, Mike D'Antoni's Phoenix Suns got knocked out of the first round of the playoffs. Apparently, Coach D'Antoni won't have much of a problem finding a new job should Phoenix wish to let him go.
Yeah, he's playing the New York Knicks off against the Chicago Bulls. My two cents, go to Chicago. You don't want any part of the circus that's in New York. But Mike D'Antoni's teams play a very entertaining style, and that's what both of those franchises need right now.
Apparently ashamed that all the Atlanta Hawks did was stretch the Boston Celtics to 7 games in the first round, Atlanta general manager Billy Knight resigned on Wednesday. Most people who saw the Atlanta-Boston series came to regard the Hawks as a team with a future, but not, I guess, Mr. Knight.
Well, they still had only won 34 games this year. They still had fewer wins than any other team in the playoffs. His tenure as a general manager was mixed. I think the biggest problem he had is that he took Marvin Williams in the draft when he could have had Deron Williams and Chris Paul, both of whom have become stars in the playoffs. The optic there wasn't good for him.
Charlie, we've had all week now to think about what happened in the Kentucky Derby, and in another week we'll witness the Preakness. Will the breakdown of 8 bells after the sport's biggest race and the discussion that has followed it change anything in thoroughbred racing?
Well, apparently there is going to be some more study on how they can try to keep the horses healthy. They are bred to be fragile, and there's no way around that. Thoroughbred racehorses are bred to be fragile. I think that, you know, the sudden decide we're going to pick on the jockey on this is preposterous. But the jockey club is going to form a committee, and they're going to have, I mean, at some level they have to realize that they have to take care of these animals because this, I mean, having, you know, nationally broadcast euthanasia is not a marketing plan for any sport.
There was good news this week for the hosts of the 2008 Beijing Summer Games. Charlie, at least one destination in the ongoing Olympic torch run was completely free of protesters.
Actually, they found it difficult to set up a picket line at the top of Mount Everest. A Tibetan woman named Chering Wangmo, and I'm sure I butchered that. The Olympics are still a mess, but this was a nice moment.
This week, French Open organizers lost in a lawsuit against three betting companies who will be allowed to take wagers on this year's French Open. That's a shame because my money was going the other way.
Actually, I think this is an unremarkable ruling. It's very hard to see that the French Open organizers having a case that their rights are somehow being violated by a betting organization which may actually raise the interest in the tournament.
And finally, Charlie,
no.
A multiple choice item for you. You are the Austrian national rugby team, and you lose 48-0 to Lithuania. Do you A, shake hands with the winners and wish them well, B, claim the officials jobbed you, or C, take off your clothes.
They all took off their clothes. And what is rule number one of the YouTube age? The camera is always on. So, yes, there was a blogger, a local blogger in Vilnius who managed to get a picture, who managed to get some video of it. Apparently, somebody in the, a bunch of people in the bar thought it was the greatest thing in the world. They clapped and cheered and stuff. And apparently, this has been interpreted by the Vilnius PD as an act of hooliganism, but they can't do anything about it because, presumably, dressed again, the Austrian team went home.
And in a bar, you say?
In a bar. Alcohol was involved in the proceedings.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Much of the email this week had to do with the Kentucky Derby. Lynn Kalnitz, who hears Only a Game on WXXI in Rochester, New York, wrote, "I hope that you don't simply skim over the terrible tragedy of eight bells. It is my opinion that horse racing is a very cruel sport." She puts sport in quotation marks. "Sure, it makes a lot of money for the owners and the gamblers, but look how so many of the animals suffer. The winners live like kings after the Derby, but what of the losers? Would you consider covering the dark side of horse racing? It's a sad day for horses and animal lovers." I hope the segment earlier in today's program speaks to those concerns. Russell Sherman emailed last Saturday morning with a striking and discouraging admission. "What was Jenny Reese's Derby pick this morning?" he asked. And then he added, "I dozed off." Dozed off? Well, Mr. Sherman, I'm inclined to tell you that our Jenny picked the winner, of course, as she always does. Except that everything's on the web now. It's too easy to check. Jenny Reese picked Colonel John, who, as far as I know, is still running. Lillian Restaino Bowman, who hears the program on WLRN in Boynton Beach, Florida, was delighted with the music that followed the item in last week's program about War Emblem, the retired champion who's been inexplicably reluctant to do his part in the production of future champions. "The music selections are always right on," Ms. Bowman wrote, "but this morning whoever chooses the music outdid him or herself. He or she should get special recognition for Don't Get Around Much Anymore after that story about War Emblem's lack of interest. Whoever that person is not only has a great sense of humor, but an incredible sense of timing. But who is that person?" Only a Game senior producer Gary Wallach gets the credit for that music choice, and for most of the music choices. Thanks for noticing, Ms. Bowman. Sanford Levy, Gary Welch, and Jereen Mortensen all emailed to say that they were happy that last week's show included a mention of the members of the Central Washington University softball team who carried an opposing player around the bases after she hit a ball over the fence but injured her knee on the base paths and could not run out the hit. But, Mr. Levy wrote, "considering the win-at-any-cost attitude rampant throughout sports, this episode deserved more than the 15 to 30 seconds it received." You, too, can register an objection or applaud it. Call us at 617-353-1860. Email us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu, or you can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Tomorrow, the May Grand Sumo Tournament opens, a 15-day run in Tokyo. This ancient, intriguing, and idiosyncratic form of wrestling offers the best of melodrama and the worst of waistlines. Only a Game's Ken Shulman recently returned from the land of the rising sun, where he learned of sumo's charms and potential dangers.
The sport's real name is Sumo Do, the way of sumo. The 700 men who wrestle in Japan's 6 annual sumo tournaments live cloistered in communal dwellings, follow a rigid code of conduct, and wear costumes and hairstyles that date back to the samurai. But the way of sumo also involves sweat, sacrifice, and occasionally, blood. In this morning workout, a 300-plus-pound wrestler pushes an even heavier stablemate again and again across the dojo, the sacred earthen mound where sumo is practiced. This isn't just a bunch of fat guys spilling out of their tasseled thongs.
It's everything. It's the smells and the sounds and the history.
Carolyn Todd is a British expat living in Kyoto. She was a winemaker in Europe before she came to Japan. Now she's a photographer who specializes in sumo.
I would one day, just for the experience, just for the Japanese experience, something you have to do, and I was there about 2 minutes, and my mouth just fell open, and that was it. It was over.
Sumo blends violence, reverence, and farce into a strangely seductive spectacle. The referee is a Shinto priest who chants as pair after pair of grapplers march towards the dojo, one from the east and one from the west. The wrestlers scatter salt and stamp their feet to purify the earthen mound. They face each other, squat, and spread their arms to show they have no weapons. They take a four-point stance, and then, on the referee's signal, they charge. In action, the grotesque physiques take on a fearsome grace. Massive legs power the wrestlers forward. Arms that seconds before seemed flabby move at lightning speed to grab and shove and slap. Bulging bellies provide ballast, along with leverage to drive an opponent out of the ring. It is one of the most electrifying 7 seconds in all of sport. In this final match on day 6 at the March tournament in Osaka, a journeyman wrestler trying to keep from dropping into the second division gets the jump on grand champion Asa Shoryu, hunkers down and drives him out of the dojo. With the upset win, scores of turquoise seat cushions fly through the air towards the ring. The announcer's appeal for calm launches a second wave of cushions, and then a third. Asa Shoryu is one of only two active yokozunas, sumo's highest ranking. He's the sport's bad boy. The 330-pound grappler once smashed a car mirror after a loss and needed an opponent when he was down. Last summer, Asa Shoryu was caught playing soccer in his native Mongolia when he was supposed to be resting a sore knee. His public mea culpa in the fall was broadcast live on all major Japanese networks. Analysts debated for days on the level of his sincerity, the tone of his voice, and the depth of his bow. Asa Shoryu's fellow yokozuna, Hokuho, is also Mongolian. In this supersized soap opera, he's the good son, with Asa Shoryu as the evil twin. Akito Kawakami is a postman from Nagoya and a longtime sumo fan.
Hokuho is an old-style yokozuna, strong and steady in the ring, with good manners and a respect for tradition. Asa Shoryu is the new style, a yokozuna with attitude. I like that. It makes for very interesting watching.
A yokozuna can make $30,000 a month or more and is expected to share his winnings with his stablemates. Most wrestlers are unpaid. Apprentices earn their keep waiting on the senior fighters. Sometimes they even wash in their dirty bathwater. Hazing is common and generally countenanced by the Sumo Association, the hyper-secretive governing council that safeguards the sport's traditions and its image. That image took a body blow last June when a 17-year-old apprentice died, apparently of abuse, after he twice tried to run away from his sumo stable. Mark Buckton is sumo columnist for the Japan Times, an editor-in-chief of Sumo Fan, an online magazine.
But the stable in which the boy died, it just went too far. Hit him with a beer bottle, apparently hit him with a baseball bat, that's still being investigated. Apparently tied him to a pole as they were hitting him. Forced him to do some very hard training for 30 minutes, well above the average for such training.
The apprentice death did draw headlines, but that scandal paled in comparison to the one Asa Shoryu sparked when he was photographed in Honolulu wearing a Hawaiian shirt instead of the requisite kimono. It's not that the Japanese don't care, says Buckton.
One boy dying, as much of a tragedy as that is, more boys will die in baseball clubs this year in Japan. Boys will die in classrooms this year in Japan. Far more than one boy in sumo. That's not taking away from the boy's death, but baseball kills far more people than sumo ever will in Japan.
With increasing competition from baseball, soccer, and basketball, sumo has struggled over the past decade to fill seats. The apprentice death and charges of match fixing have brought an unwelcome media spotlight to a sport that doesn't even allow advertising in its stadiums. And some of the old guard grumbles about Asa Shoryu, the foreign yokozuna, who neither talks the talk nor walks the way of sumo. Yet lately, on tournament days, The entire country stops each afternoon at 5:45 when Hokuho and then Asashoryu take the doyo. It may be that most of them tune in hoping to see the wayward Yokozuna fall. But it also may be that with its Prince of Light, and especially with its Prince of Darkness, Japan's beefiest daytime drama is ripe for a revival. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Osaka, Japan.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino, Jim Doyle, Debbie Andriano, Walter Dixon, and James Ross. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Sumo photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Arnie and Jack author Ian O'Connor, who responds to my dismay that I will always associate Arnold Palmer with his favorite cigarette brand because it is mentioned so frequently in the book.
Oh, no. No, that was just probably, I don't know how many times I actually referenced it, but I probably should have cut it in half if it left you with that impression.
Please note that I have not mentioned that brand once. No product placement here. Have you bought your Mother's Day flowers yet? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.